Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age podcast, continuing recap of The Gathering Storm. I, of course, am Andrew Gallows, and with me this episode is Spencer.
Hi, everyone. It is great to be here. Unfortunately, Virginia is not going to be able to join us this episode. Because just the way the schedule worked out and our need to record, get these episodes recorded and out to you, it's the 9th of October right now as we're recording, so we don't have very long left until the release of Towers of Midnight, and so we're working really hard to finish getting these recorded, edited, and out as soon as possible. We're going to be starting this week with Chapter 42, but before we jump into it, just a couple of quick notes. First off, we need to thank encyclopedia-watt.org for the meat of the chapter summaries that we're using. We aren't quite reading them word for word, but the majority of the actual information is coming from Encyclopedia Watt. Secondly, very important,
brethren, how fares this world?
Edge is on edge, my lord. All the readers await Tarmon Gaidon. They seem to expect the light to triumph. They cannot understand the glory of the shadow.
The chosen dwindle, Mandrin. The weak fall away. I cannot save those who disregard spoiler warnings. Even I cannot step outside of time. Done by my ancient enemies, the podcasters of the Fourth Age. Would you unleash the spoilers in my service, Demandrin?
As you command, great lord, so shall I obey.
Then listen and spur. Hear who will die and who will live in chapters of books not yet released.
Obviously, we're talking about The Gathering Storm, which, you know, leads us to talk about every book in the series. So, you know, as the Dark One and Demandrin said there, if you've not read through all of the books and you don't want to be spoiled, you should probably tune out until you have, and then come back and listen to us then.
We're going to start with Chapter 42, which is entitled Before the Stone of Tyr. This is from Rand's point of view, and it starts with him riding Paedashar along the streets of Vandarivan with Min, preparing to leave for Tyr. Sin and Nyeth are leading the way, and Lutheran is upset that he can't continue the list because they don't know the names of the woman that they killed when they balefired Grendel. Rand thinks that he has failed in Ered Domon. In other nations, he brought stability, but in Ered Domon, it's going to be trampled by the Seanchan and the last battle. He couldn't locate enough members of the Council of Merchants to elect a new king, although Brashear reports that Milasar Chandmir and Alamindra Kutrin and the other members of the Council of Merchants that they were able to find have been returned to their palaces. Brashear also reports that Iteralda has had skirmishes with the Shadow Spawn up in the borderlands. They are massing in the Blight, so they are probably in Tarmon's Gap as well. Rand thinks to himself that he'll have to deal with the borderlands next. When they reach the city square, Rand signals Flynn and Nyeth to open the gateways. As Rand starts through a gateway, one of the dockmasters runs up and reports that all the food that has been sent has spoiled, every last bit of it. Vandarivan will starve. Rand can do nothing about this, so he rides through the gateway to Feaster's Run, which is a main city square in Tyr, where the people are gathered and they cheer for him. The Aes Sedai, Bedelene, Corlene, Aran, Maurice, Serene, and others, the Aiel, the Saldians, all of these follow Rand through the gateway. Catswain and Nynaeve were not in the manor when Rand announced his departure, but he is sure that they will, if they're not part of the group, they will be following soon after. Rand is not going to be hiding anymore. He doesn't have the time for it, especially with Lon and the Malkieri riding to Tarwin's Gap. Rand brings up the Borderlanders, and Brashear has no idea why Tenobia and the others would leave the Blight undefended. They arrive at the Stone of Tyr, where King Darlin and O'Brien lead a welcoming delegation. Wearmon is also there, and Luthaeran thinks that he likes Wearmon because he is loyal and honest. Lady Carlane is there with Darlin. She reminds Rand too much of Moraine, and Luthaeran begins chanting the list. All the other High Lords and ladies are there, along with Alana. Darlin reports that the army is ready for Ar-Domhan, but Rand replies that they can no longer help the Domani. They will march to Sheol Ghul.
Yeah, this was kind of a crushing chapter, just because, you know, you always expect your hero to have some failures along the way, but, I mean, really, Rand leaving in this kind of disgrace seems almost like a crushing defeat. I mean, he literally accomplished nothing that he set out to do in Ar-Domhan except get rid of Grendel, we think.
Well, and get Etheralda into the Borderlands. But other than that, you're right that nothing that needed to happen there did. Part of this is the fact that Rand had gone so dark that his Severinness, or whatever you wish to call it, his bending of random chance, rather than being balanced as it usually had, is now 100% completely negative at this point in time. And so just with Rand there being that powerful to Severin, and it being all negative, just an insatiable sense of doom would descend on the city, you know? People dying left and right. It mentions, scrolling up now to find the chapter, but it mentions all sorts of, back when Cad Swain was, talking with one of her eyes and ears, you know, he mentions that there are so many negative things happening, and it doesn't list them in Encyclopedia Watt, so I'm going to have to open it up. There's stillborn children, men dying from falls that should barely have caused a bruise, stones toppling from buildings, and spikes striking women dead as they trade. With all of this happening, even though, like I said, that people don't like to talk about it because it really is creepy and scary to them. It's not natural, not normal, but it's happening. There's none of the other. And so there's just this pervasive sense of doom on the city. I mean, even, and then as he leaves, to have all the food that he had brought in, he had the sea folk bring food to them, and it's all just gone bad, just immediately spoiled.
Well, and I mean, it's precipitous because the food goes bad almost, you know, on the instant that he is preparing to leave. I mean, this is something that, you know, if it had been even an hour before he decided, you know, you could say, oh, well, that's you know, the Dark One's effect on the land, that's, you know, reality unweaving. You know, it seems really significant that Rand decides he can't do anything for the Ar-Domhan, and every bit of food that he sent to try to help them spoils. Every last bit. I mean, it really is that kind of, yeah, the profound, you know, extension of Rand's Taverin, you know, yeah, it's like that profound kind of extension of Rand's, you know, control over his Taverin power. I mean, this is almost harkening back to Rand learning to use the One Power when, like, in, you know, the early portions of the Dragon Reborn, you know, he's in the bowl where they've got, you know, in the mountains waiting, and the Trollocs and Murdrel attack, and, you know, Perrin's fighting down there, and, you know, the Shinarans, they're all fighting, and, you know, Rand finally gets a hold of the One Power, and he wants to just, you know, use fire and ignite all of the Trollocs and the Murdrel and the Bull and that, and instead he ends up, you know, setting fire to some trees, which, you know, is a wonderful distraction, but, you know, and at this point, and we mentioned last episode with Virginia, that Rand seems to actually be exerting control over, his Taveran nature and the way it twists things. And this just kind of reeks of a psychological effect that he's unconsciously affecting how the Taveran nature twists certain chances. He decides, I can't do anything for these people, and the food that he has sent goes bad. So it seems like, you know, a reference back to, you know, even how he learned or started to learn to channel too.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I mean, obviously I did think of trying to, what looks like actually trying to control the pattern because of his Taveran nature, going back to his meeting with Tuon and what he did there. It just seems like he's somehow, and we're not sure how because we haven't been in his head when he's done it, but somehow actually controlling the pattern, and not in a good way because Rand has gone crazy right now. He's not sane. Of course, he hasn't been sane for a while, but now he's even worse than we've seen. But I hadn't thought about the times when he's trying to master the One Power. Now you bring it up. You bring up the moment in Dragon Reborn. But I'm also thinking of, I'm pretty sure it was it must have been Path of Daggers, when the Ashaman are fighting the Shanshan outside of Ilion to hold them back, to hold them in Altara, basically, to keep them from coming into Ilion and continuing their return. The ball of lightning that he makes and just kills everything. It kind of has that feeling to me where Rand is just going crazy and doesn't really know what to do, and so he just kind of lashes out using whatever tools he has, whether it's the One Power or the True Power or his Taveran nature, just lashes out at everything around him, the people, the pattern itself. I mean, we see later on, big spoiler warning for later on, we see him lash out at the world, at the pattern, at all creation. It's a good thing that, you know, that he stops before he goes too far, but still. That's really what this chapter does. It just shows us even more Rand being even darker and scarier. I mean, honestly, he just rides away. He just rides away. If the Rand that had existed before Falme, because to me, that's the major turning point is Falme, when he first gets, to my mind, that's where he gets corrupted first, is after Falme, the first wound that won't heal, is what really starts affecting his psyche. Because it's not until after that, in the Mountains of Mist, that we see Rand starting to go crazy. Before that, he's the farm boy, he's kind of the generic farm boy who's been thrust into a hero role, doesn't want to be there, doesn't really know how to be there. After Falme, he goes crazy. You know, the Rand that we had seen before that, even if there was nothing he could have done, he would have stayed and tried to do something. He wouldn't have just run away. He would have tried to do something. This, he just turns his back and walks away. I could just imagine the dock master, what's his name, Irulan. Just imagine what he's feeling. He runs up, tells the Dragon Reborn, the savior of the world, the bane of everyone's existence too, but the savior of the world, we don't have any food left. It's all gone bad. We're going to starve. What are you going to do about it? And he just leaves? How do you handle that?
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, I think there's really very little that can be done that way. It really does kind of just return over to, you know, Banderhaban's not in a good way. Yara Duman is not in a good way. And in a series like this, we have to expect that part of the coming of the end of the world is that things go bad. I mean, up until now, we've had bad events happen, but really nothing that the general people can't recover from. In any other series that you look at, and we will go out of our way not to mention a few of them, by the time the end of their world comes, the place is a disaster all over the place. I mean, everywhere. And we really haven't had that in the Wheel of Time yet. I mean, everything has been, oh, there was a big battle, or there's been a war, And yes, those are terrible, horrible things, but, you know, we've never really had, like, suddenly, oh, look, there's just nothing that can be done about this because it's a quote-unquote natural phenomenon, you know, that just points towards the end of the world. You know, that's what the people are facing right now.
And you can definitely tell that something is looming over the horizon, even if we don't know exactly what.
Moving on from that rather depressing chapter, we head into chapter 43, Sealed to the Flame. We begin with Egwene, as she sits in her tent, attended by Chessa. She thinks her, quote-unquote, rescue is a disaster. She blames herself, as well as Siwan, Gawain, and Bryn. She cannot return to the White Tower as prisoner. Elida would have her executed out of hand. With Rand and the Shanshan, the stalemate cannot continue. Her only recourse seems to be to use her army to attack. She does not know Elida's status, but she must assume that she is still in control. In order to succeed, she feels that she must use the best aspects that she has learned exist within each Aj within herself. She opens the tent flap to find Gawain right there. He seems even more attractive to her than Galad, but she is furious with him, and he stubbornly refuses to accept that rescuing her was a mistake. She heads to the Hall of Sitters. There, we then switch to the point of view of Jesse Bilal, the Aj heads Jesse Bilal, Aed Lorna, Suana Dragund, Ferain Nehera, and Sarancha Kulveen meet to discuss what to do about the leadership in the White Tower. Tutsama is too new to her position to be a part of this meeting. The five of them have secretly been working together to try to manage Elida. This has happened before in the history of the White Tower, notably during the reign of Kamael Sorathane. Their attempts completely failed, and now the tower is adrift without a leader. Their attempts to manage the rebellion by secretly sending junior sitters to join the rebels and appointing temporary replacements has also failed. Many of the junior sitters actually came to sympathize with the rebels. They agree that they can no longer salvage their plans and need to select a new Amerlin. Each suggests sisters from her own Aj, or such as Saren Ansabar or Sain or Hiramon, and each is promptly shot down. Aed Lorna finally suggests Egwene, and the others agree. They will choose an Amerlin of strength. We then switch back to the rebel camp. Siwan watches as Sharium closes the flap to the hall. A ward against eavesdropping appears. Gareth Bryn comes up. She thinks that she has lost Egwene's trust by disobeying her, but Egwene did not realize how close she was to losing control of the rebels. Bryn tells her that his second demand will be that she marry him, but he will wait until her mission to save the world is completed. Siwan thinks he really doesn't understand her. And then we shift back to Egwene's point of view. In the hall, Humesa weaves a ward against eavesdropping. There are only 12 sitters present, as each Aja sent one to the Black Tower. The Grey Aja replaced Delana with Nauris Ercombral. Sharium wears a badge on her bandage on her left hand. Ramonda looks satisfied, while Lelaine looks sulky. Varlan asks what news she brings. First things first, Egwene reveals that she has taken the oath rod from the tower, retrieved late last night, from her pouch, and swears the three oaths. She tells them that one of the Black Aja confessed to her. She states that she is not a dark friend and tells them they will each have to re-swear the three oaths. Sharium embraces the true source and Egwene shields her. Virana cries out. Egwene questions Sharium and tricks her into a lie. She tells Sharium it was Varen who came to her. Moria tries to escape, and she is caught as well. Each of the remaining sitters re-swears the oaths, proving themselves. Takima asks if there are others, and Egwene replies that there are over 270 in the rebel camp. They will seize them one Aj at a time. Bryn will set up a perimeter for sisters and warders who try to escape. Once the camp is cleansed, the army will begin the assault on the White Tower. She tells them to pass the word. The news will be a distraction to cover their work.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things that happen in here. I want to jump first back, because right now it's what I'm thinking of, and I don't want to forget it, first back to the meeting with the Aja heads. First off, this explains a lot. You know, it explains the mystery of the two young sitters. It explains the secret meetings of the Aja heads, what actually goes on. I find it interesting, though, in the actual text, nowhere in it do they actually mention Egwene's name. They just say, you know, there's already someone who would be perfect as Almerlin. We just have to go get her. And everyone else like, oh, yes, there is crap. It's really interesting little meeting to be able to look in on and see. You know, there's a couple of questions that are left here, though. One of them is, how do they know each other? How do they know that each of them is the Aja head? Especially, and how do they know that Tsutsama has taken over as the head of the Red Aja? You know, the only way I can see it working is if sitters are secretly meeting and discussing to make sure that the Aja heads know. Because everyone knows that the sitters are the sitters, and they can meet together and discuss whatever they need to. And so if they're meeting together and saying, my Aja head wants to meet with your Aja head, can we set up a time and place? You know, then they can figure that out. But it just seems really, really interesting that they know who each other are. They know who all the Aja heads know who all the other heads are in the rest of the tower. And then, of course, there's also the little tidbit that, by the way, we sent sitters to the little tower, the rebel camp to, you know, guide them and help bring them back into the fold. These women did have good intentions, and they really did have some good ideas, except for the fact that there were Black Aja who were working just as hard to keep the chaos going, and they didn't plan for that. They didn't allocate for that. And you have Romanda and Elaine, who are both making a mad grab for power, and they didn't plan for that either. But other than that, they probably would have done really well.
It's hard to say exactly, you know, how those inner workings of the White Tower really work. And I mean, truthfully, it does basically come down to, I would say that the sitters do kind of have to speak within each other before they end up selecting the Aj heads, just because, you know, I want to say just kind of like your common courtesy. You know, it's like, oh, well, by the way, we're appointing a new Aj head, you know, obviously so-and-so, blah, 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 is dead or whatever. And it seems like that would be the most apparent way to get that information through. I mean, I don't know exactly what purpose that really serves. I mean, but I mean, it would make enough sense that I could see it happening. I don't know. It was really weird. Well, at the same time, this answered a lot of questions. It was kind of, at least for me, a little bit of a letdown, because it seemed like, oh, well, by the way, all this mystery and everything that you've been kind of wondering about for three or four books now, we're going to solve in an amazingly quick scene just by saying, oh yeah, this has happened before, and you know, people have had to do this before, and yep, nothing's really out of the ordinary here. I mean, it seemed like, as a red herring plot, which, let's face it, that's what it kind of was, it was one that really didn't quite have the punch I expected from it. You know, that being said, you know, it was brilliant as a, you know, keeping the audience off balance, that, you know, in its resolution, we find out, oh, well, there was actually a kind of practical reason that the sitters were all too young. You know, we're looking for something really insidious, and not so much, no.
Your sitters are all too young, because guess what? They're going to get replaced when the tower comes back together. Yeah, well, and then when I first read it, the first thing I thought of was trying to remember. I don't remember which book it is. Which book is it when Egwene gets called back to the, gets called to the Little Tower? Called from, to come from the, Aiel to the Little Tower to be there, Amarlin.
I want to say that happens in Lord of Chaos. I might be wrong about that.
But it made me think of the little tidbit that we were told there, that the summons for a woman who, or an initiate to come and, become the Amarlin is the same as the summons for an initiate who needs to come, who is coming as a criminal and is coming to be tried and punished for her offenses. And so I was wondering how that was going to work, just what was going to happen, because if they stuck to tradition, the calling of Egwene to come be the Amarlin for the White Tower have been, you know, the same call as they would, should, that they would have given to Egwene to at the prisoner who had been in the White Tower forever, and the Saladar, I said, the rebels didn't know that Elida had been out of power. So it could have been a little bit more interesting in my mind than what we end up with, but that's okay.
That's true. And that is very true. Of course, you know, in this same chapter, we also get the first of a couple Gawain and Egwene scenes that, you know, in my mind reinforce our earlier supposition in a previous podcast that Gawain might have had his mind messed with by Missana or one of the other Forsaken, just because, again, you know, Gawain's attitude is just so horribly stubborn and in some ways patriarchal. I mean, he really is kind of putting on the well, I'm the man, blah, blah, blah kind of, you know, attitude that I really would not have expected out of him from the early books.
Well, no. I mean, honestly, he's the first prince of Andor who is, which is basically a matriarchal society. They only have queens. And then he goes to Tar Valon, which is definitely a matriarchal society. Where does he get this idea of I'm the man and I must take care of my woman?
Yeah, I have no idea. And, you know, it's also that entire, well, we're going to, no, we need to talk about this now. No, you need to get out of my way. I mean, that seems like, that really does seem to be the extent of Egwene and Gawain's conversations. This, you know, for the rest of this book, seems to be the, you need to get out of my way because I need to do the things that I need to do to restore, you know, my sisterhood to its proper status.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we see. They do make sure to tell, yes, they're both still in love with each other. But Egwene has a job that needs doing, and Gawain is really, really getting in the way of this. And so, you know, I do have to wonder. Obviously, we have the Gawain's going crazy over the craziness that is Gawain and Rand. And but also this with him and Egwene, it's just too much to my mind for him not, too much out of character in my mind. The character that we know from The Eye of the World and Great Hunt up until about Dragon Reborn when the girls disappear for the second time. And he has no idea where they've gone, which, you know, there's been plenty of time, there's been plenty of Forsaken that could have done anything to him. I mean, we had Robin and Caitlin, who may or may not have put a compulsion on him to keep him out of the way. We also had Missana and Lanfear in the White Tower. So there's been plenty of opportunity for him to have been compulsionified. Whether or not he has been, we don't know yet. I hope he has, because I liked Gawain. I still kind of like him sometimes, but not if he's always this big of an idiot.
I really hope that we get a turnaround for him in the upcoming books, because, you know, I am one of those people. I want to see the happy ending. I want to see Egwene and Gawain, you know, get together and be, you know, at least as happy a couple as they possibly can be. And right now, it really looks like Egwene's going to be tolerant of him at best, and he's going to be, you know, a jerk, you know, up until the point that someone has to really set him down a lot more, and I don't know, I really don't know what it's going to take to do that. But, you know, talking about couples as well, we also get Gareth's second condition, and honestly, this one was seeable a mile away. You know, Steve? Oh, well, the first condition is you make me your warder.
Yeah.
Okay, well, when's the marriage proposal coming? And, you know, yeah. It seems interesting that it's, we kind of talked about this last episode, you know, it's Gareth saying, well, this is a condition, you know, you need to do this. And, you know, it's that same sort of style that they've had, you know, only here we actually get a little bit of, you know, almost bashfulness on Gareth's part, which is kind of amusing. It's just, you know, I kind of thought that the second condition was, do you marry me? And, you know, Sawan's like, you know, and I have to point out that the summary of this section doesn't get into the point that, you know, Sawan, you know, really does love Gareth too, and, you know, it ends with, you know, her leaning on him as they're watching the tent where the hall is gathered. So,
and you know, I love the little interaction, but the fact that Brian has come to know her so well, the fact that she is dedicated, she has this purpose in life. She's a blue, obviously. She has this purpose in life that she's working on and working towards. And he's almost being the exact opposite of Gawain here. He's not getting in the way. He's saying, I'm going to help you as much as possible, and when you're done with it, I'm going to be here and you're going to marry me. Okay? Okay, we're good. Which is, like, it's the absolute opposite of Gawain, who is trying to butt his way in head first. Well, it's obvious now that they were written to be the opposites of one another, so we could see the two. We could see the difference.
Yeah, there are some contrasting parallels here, which is which is good. Sets up, you know, foils to one another a little bit, not completely, but in certain ways.
Yeah, I love also how there is no real normal relationship in the book amongst any of our main characters. I mean, I'm thinking now the only normal relationship between the male and female that I can think of in the book is the Alvier's, Egwene's parents.
Mm, true.
We have Rand and his three women. We have Nynaeve and her husband, who's going to kill himself. We have Perrin and Faile, which is, there's no normal relationships.
So that, of course, brings us to Egwene's lot to reforge the Aes Sedai. We should note out that Sheriam is carrying a bandage, or is wearing a bandage on her hand. Obviously, she's was one Dream Tarangriel short at Mesana's deadline, and, you know, as a result, has lost one of her fingers. I think they make mention that, you know, she said she lost it in, like, an accident or something, and you know, well, why no one healed or anything. Her cover is getting really thin at this point, and, you know, just them finally bringing in and Egwene rapid firing questions at her so that she would eventually slip and lie without realizing that she had done it, you know. And then, of course, you know, her immediate reaction was, well, I didn't, you know, I was just answering questions as they came. I wasn't listening to the questions, you know, ends up falling a little.
Well, I think it's fair, but still, because honestly, if obviously we know that a person down can tell a lie if they believe it's true, and if you're not listening to the question and you believe that the question is asking something it's not, and you give an answer that you believe is true to the question that you're hearing, even if it's not the question that's being asked, but that's a completely different story. Yeah, the culling of the Black Aja. Honestly, I think it's something she should have saved until later. I really do. I think it's way too early, especially where later we find out that, you know, it gives time for the Black Aja in the tower to escape, to root themselves out and get out. But so it's something that should have waited until after she had the White Tower back together under one banner again. In the same vein, also her plan to attack the White Tower is absolutely outrageous. I think it would have been much more effective if, rather than a military coup, if she had just decided to gather up all the sisters, go in with a shield ready, both physical and one power shield, so that if they are attacked, they can put down whatever attack there is, and not as weapons, as defensive measures, so, you know, you can get away with it that way. And then they just walk in and take over, because the White Tower, she knows that the White Tower has been pretty much shattered at this point. The remaining tatters are all that's left after the Shanshan attack. There was no reason for a military presence to have to go in. They could have simply walked. I mean, they're Aes Sedai. The Tower Guard would have had to let them in because they are Aes Sedai. And so they just walk in and take over. I don't know why she didn't think of that. That's okay. It worked out in the end.
Yeah, it's true. I agree, obviously, that it would have been better if she'd been able to gather everyone before doing the roundup and, you know, the scourging of the Aes Sedai, of the Black Aja. Unfortunately, I kind of think that if they'd waited until they were all in the tower, there's just too many ways for people to escape and not enough ways to, you know, create a perimeter in which they couldn't escape. And I really do think that, you know, by doing at least half of it in the rebel camp, they probably ended up catching more people than they would have if they waited. Just because I really think that word can get out much easier in a structure the size of the White Tower, and there is no real way to guard all the exits, you know. So, kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other, because, you know, we really don't know what would have happened if they tried it the other way. The attack, yeah, I mean, the attack really is just there to set up the forward momentum of the plot. I really don't think that even at this point they could have come to, oh, we're going to take the White Tower with, you know, a physical force. I mean, by now, the Aes Sedai, they've gotten their nose bloodied by the Shanshan. And yes, they're unorganized, but if another attack came immediately, suddenly you know that all of the One Power Force would, you know, just be thrown directly. I mean, it would have been a much more difficult battle than it will end up being. So
there's probably a lot more to talk about in these chapters, but we do need to get moving on just to get through our recap. So we're going to move on now to chapter 44, which is Sense Unknown. This is a Nynaeve point of view. It starts with Rand riding Tidashar again, to his meeting with the Borderlanders delegation. He's with Nynaeve, Nourishma, Nynaeve, and 200 Aiel guards. Nynaeve is riding the horse Moonlight. The meeting is at a crossroads some distance away. The maidens convinced Rand not to travel directly to the meeting place. Nynaeve, as they're going, is trying to convince Rand to support Lon and his Malkyrie at Tarwin's Gap. Rand has reports from Mithralda that the Trollocs are massing in the Blight, and he refuses. He will not attack the Shadow. He will not attack where the Shadow dictates. He no longer cares about anyone or anything but fighting the Dark One at any cost. Nynaeve thinks that she has no choice now but to help Cad Swain in her plan. She asks Rand if he knows where Perrin is. He says that he has not been meeting with Perrin. But he does know where he is. He and Perrin and Matt are connected. The crossroads is no longer important. Perhaps Varen could say why. That's an interesting note. I'm not entirely sure what it's referring to. The crossroads where they're meeting seems like at some point it was important, but it no longer is. Perhaps Varen would have known why, but it is a remnant of the nation that is now the far-off city-state of Farmadding. Nynaeve falls back now, and she rides with Nourishma, Maurice, and the other Aes Sedai, not necessarily two. Maurice and the other Aes Sedai were furious when Rand did not let them come, but he demanded a balance. The four channelers and 200 Aiel in his party and no more than 4 Aes Sedai and 200 men from the Borderlanders' camp. Nerishma has no idea why they left the defense against the Blight. Of course, his loyalty is now to Rand, not to his homeland. The Aiel scouts return to report that the Borderlanders have great honor. There is only one man in their delegation. They ride forward and discover that it is Hurin, the, if you don't remember Hurin, he's the, sniffer that went with Rand and the rest of the delegation from Farmadding during the Great Hunt to get the Horn of Valir back. Rand callously wraps him in air and questions him to prove that he is real. Nynaeve, of course, feels sorry for Hurin. He spent a lot of time with Rand chasing Fain and the Horn. Oh, that explained that, on their return trip to Tar Valon, it was clear that he idolized Rand. And Hurin says, though, that he smells something terrible, like death and violence, only darker. He doesn't pinpoint this on Rand, but Hurin tells Rand that he is there to set up a more formal meeting. The Borderland leaders want badly to meet with him, but they require that he come inside the Guardian at Farmadding. Rand cuts him off and opens the gateway to a point a short way back on the road. They all ride through, and Rand opens another gateway to the wooded hollow where they stopped after leaving Farmadding. Traveling to a place once learns it well enough to travel from there immediately. Rand rides out of the hollow to where he can see Farmadding and the army around it. He has a fit of madness now. Rand says that they want to capture him and put him in a box again. The access key in his hand begins to glow, and Rand says that he will teach them a lesson. Frantically, Nynaeve talks him out of raining lightning on the army, saying that there will be no turning back if he does that. Rand calmly says that there has been no turning back since Tam found him on Dragonmount. But the access key does stop glowing. He gives Hurin a message. The Dragon Reborn rides to Sheol Ghul. He will return the army to their duty at the Blight if they wish. If they don't, they can stay here in hiding and explain their failure to their grandchildren. Leaving Hurin, Rand opens another gateway back to Tyr. As they dismount at the Stone of Tyr stable yards, Rand tells Nynaeve that Perrin is camped near a huge stone statue with a sword that is point down. He is telling her this as he owes her a debt for caring when he cannot. As she enters the stone, she sees the place where Matt blasted a hole with Illuminator's fireworks to rescue her. She has not seen him since Ibudar fell to the Shanshan. She wonders why she embarrassed herself in front of the Daughter of the Nine Moons over him. She goes to Cad Swain's room and finds her with Maurice, Corell, and Min. Nynaeve tells them that she knows where Perrin is, but demands to know the plan before she will tell. She also tells them how badly the meeting went. Cad Swain mutters that she will teach him to laugh again. Corell says that none of it matters. Min's viewing indicates that they will win. Min disagrees, and Cad Swain says she is right. Min views the pattern, but if Rand loses, the pattern will be destroyed. Nynaeve describes the statue, and Cad Swain says that she knows what it is and where it is. They will go to Perrin right now. She then accedes and answers Nynaeve's question. They are not after Perrin. They are after someone with him. And we will finally find out who and why in, you know, chapter 47. So there's a lot of little interesting points in this chapter. First off, we see Hurin again, which is a delight, honestly. To be quite honest, like the week before the release, I had been thinking, you know, I wonder whatever happened to Hurin. We haven't seen him since the Dragon Reborn, and then we finally see him again, and that was cool. The fact that as a sniffer he can smell violence and death in this. And we remember him saying when he smelled Fain and was following Fain that it was something weird that he hadn't smelled before. But again, here, he has something even different. Something terrible like death and violence, only darker. And we know that this is Rand because, well, we don't know that this is Rand, but it's pretty safe to assume that this is Rand. And then he goes on and he's going to, you know, slaughter the entire Borderland army. I mean, what the heck?
Well, not even just the army. I mean, I could just rain down fire on top of them, and that nothing prevents the things falling from the sky from hitting Farmadding itself either. I mean, as much as the artificial steading thing works, you know, like Matt's, you know, Foxhead Tarongreal or any other you know, sort of device that negates the One Power, certain things can get through. It's not necessarily a, you know, safe thing. And honestly, in his state, you know, Rand's, the entire idea of formatting is, you know, an insult to Rand, because, I mean, it is. It's one of the few places that he has been as, you know, thoroughly set down as he is, you know, in the series. You know, there's been the box, which, you know, came from his own arrogance, but, you know, he was eventually able to escape. There was formatting where he, you know, other people had to talk him out. You know, he got caught in, you know, what was essentially an illegal action, and, you know, slammed into a cell, and that's where they were holding him. So it's like, you know, this is not a very pleasant place, and honestly, the Borderlanders really should have thought. You know, obviously, I know they wanted to send Hurin because he was familiar with Rand and figured, well, you know, he'd be able to, you know, get Rand to talk and whatnot, but Rand's progressed far too much for that. You know, I really do think that Hurin was probably Aglamar's idea, and Aglamar is probably still remembering the farm boy that came to him, you know, a couple years ago, and, you know, it's not that way anymore. Honestly, yeah. I really do think that the Borderlanders by this point should have just gone back to the Borderlands. The idea that they're, you know, it didn't really hit me until more recently that, yeah, they really have only left a token defense at the Blight. And it's like, you know, you just set up a recipe for total disaster in the Borderlands. So, you know, in some ways, you know, Rand's message about, you know, well, I'm marching there. If you want to go back to your post, I'll send you. But if not, and you want to hide down here, well, you can explain it to your grandchildren.
We have no idea what the heck the Borderlanders are doing. It's the same thing as with Gawain. This is so far out of character for what we know of these people, what we know of who they are, what they are, why they are, that it seems like some external force is acting on them. Because of that, several people have postulated that Demondred has a hand in it, which we could be. Honestly, I think we jump on the their compulse bandwagon a little bit too often. I think it's kind of a cheat way out. I think that Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson are better writers than to use the, oh, they were compulse option button too many times as almost a deus ex machina. You know, we have this character that we like, and then, okay, I'm going to make a crossover to Harry Potter. It's the same as the Death Eaters thing. Oh, I was under the Imperius curse the whole time. It wasn't my fault. And so that they can blend back in with normal society. You know, it kind of has that feel to it. And so I think that maybe we use it too often because these are characters that we want to like. We don't want them to be evil or mad or crazy. And so we say, oh, they must be compulsed. Well, not necessarily. I could understand if they came with a small, almost token delegation or even sent one, you know, staying in the Borderlands to fight themselves. But no, they came out with pretty much the full armies of the Borderlanders, plus everything that they would need to sustain said army, and left the Borderlands wide open, which is why Rand had to send Ithralda up there with his army to hold back the Shadowspawn. I mean, what the heck?
Definitely a lot going on here, and I do agree. We kind of hop on the compulsion bandwagon a little too easily now at this point in the series, and it's because it is such a powerful tool that, you know, it just seems like, well, if someone's not behaving properly, compulsion. So, yeah, I mean, it does set up a lot of probably unintentional red herrings that we just, you know, we can't really help.
The best red herring in the entire series is the fact that Robert Jordan introduced compulsion.
Yep. You know, I know a lot of the rest of this chapter deals with Nynaeve and her feelings over various topics. You know, you have her thinking about Matt and kind of, again, thinking back to the old days, and I don't really know where to go with that.
Yeah.
Part,
Well, I think it's a little late to bring it up, but I wasn't there when this chapter was discussed, you know, back with the meeting with Tuon. It says Nynaeve isn't entirely sure why she embarrassed herself in front of the daughter of the Nine Moons over him, but it is kind of interesting when you think that Nynaeve doesn't know it, but that she was defending Matt in front of his wife.
Yeah. It's also, I mean, Nynaeve's not sure why she defended Matt. Yes, she is. I mean, Matt,
yeah.
he might be a little childish at times, and, you know, even she doesn't really know that because, you know, they've not been close to each other for a while now. But yeah, no, she totally knows that, you know, that why she defended him. I mean, it's the same reason that she left the Two Rivers in the first place. Matt is one of her people, and, you know, she's not going to let somebody bad, or she's not going to let somebody talk, you know, down about somebody who is one of her people. It just, you know, that is her natural nature. You know, one of the primary reasons that she, you know, continues to, you know, try to help Rand despite, you know, the rather dark twist that he's, you know, taken is that, you know, despite everything else, he still is an Emmons Fielder. That's just, it's born and bred in Nynaeve that, you know, she has to look out for and try to do what she can for them. You know, I do kind of like the entire, there's a little, that entire meeting that she has with Rand where she's trying to get Perrin's location out of him. And, you know, it just the sheer confusion of, no, we haven't been talking, we haven't been meeting. Don't ask me how I know, I just know. You know,
yeah.
you've done me some good turns recently here. I don't know why you want to know where Perrin is, but there he is.
That's another really interesting relationship, is that between Rand and Nynaeve. Because, you know, he Rand kind of, after he got rid of Chad Swain, he said to Nynaeve, well, isn't this what you wanted? Didn't you want to be my number one advisor? Well, that's not what Nynaeve is. That's not what she's there for. Honestly, Nynaeve is there to be his grounding rod, the thing that keeps him in the world and keeps him thinking of the people, especially from her point of view. She's trying to remind him of who he was, of Emmons Field and the Two Rivers folk, to the people, to remembering that there's more to the world than the Dark One and the Dark Friends and Forsaken and Shadowspawn. That there's good people in the world that need to be looked after, because they don't need to be looked after, although she seems to think they do. But and then there's this one really kind of important tidbit. You know, we have, I love how Coraline says, well, none of this matters. We have men's viewing. We know that we're going to win because men has viewings, and we've had foretellings and such of times after the last battle and things that have happened after the last battle. So we know that we have to win. And then men's like, no, we don't, because I'm just viewing the pattern. It's all this. We're looking at the pattern. And if we lose and the Dark One wins, the pattern gets destroyed. So, you know, I think that was more for the readers than it was for any of the characters in the book. For the readers to say, oh my gosh, she's right, you know, we've assumed that all these things will happen because of foretellings and such, and, you know, some information that we have that's not in the book, you know, information we have from Robert Jordan and you know, his plans concerning it. You know, we assume that everything's going to be all hunky-dory and happy and birds will sing and the sun will rise again tomorrow. Or it might rise again sometime, you know, late in the evening. We don't know. But we don't know. We have no idea what's going to happen, because if the Dark One wins, then guess what? All bets are off.
Yeah. And of course, that brings us at last to, you know, Cad Swain's revelation that Perrin is not the one that she is after, and we'll figure out who she is after in Chapter 47. But if you really, really think about it, it's not too difficult to really guess who Cad Swain's actually after, particularly as it pertains to Rand. But that will be for a later chapter.
Yep.
So, we will be moving on. Because they are linked together, we will continue with both chapters 45 and 46. Chapter 45, The Tower Stands, is from Egwene's point of view. She walks through the camp, preparing for the assault on the White Tower. Samhain found her great serpent ring. She wears a red dress to symbolize reunification with the Red Aja, as well as the blood that has been spilled. Over 50 Black Aja sisters were stilled and beheaded. She can see Sheriam on the block. A rare golden sunbeam lit her fiery red hair and blue dress as the silvery axe descended. They only discovered 3 Black Aja sisters whose names were not in Baron's list. Nearly 20 escaped. The warders are under guard until they can be sorted out. Some sitters argued for questioning, but Egwene would not repeat her mistake with Mogedion. Lelaine reports that the army is ready to move. Ravonda reports that there has been no word from the Black Tower embassy. In addition to the sitters, the embassy included Nisal, Murel, Theodrin, and Faulaine. Why all women sworn to Egwene? Lelaine then reports that Sheriam's story was true. All the Dream Tarongreal are missing. They are all disturbed by Sheriam's other claim that one of the Forsaken is in the White Tower. They reach the edge of the camp, where there is a large group of soldiers as well as a sitter from each Aja. They mount, and Egwene sees Gawain following her. They ride to the outskirts of Darien. They can see the White Tower, wounded but still standing. Bryn and Samhain are waiting. Egwene guesses correctly that she has bonded him. Egwene tells Samhain that she is angry and that Samhain must regain her trust. Bryn leads her through Darien to the Alendir Bridge so she can see the force of 1,000 Tower Guard on the other side. The army can cut them down, but it will be bloody. She asks Bryn if he agrees with the assault. He says it is not his place to make an opinion, but the rebels have lost their advantage of traveling, and the White Tower will never be weaker. It is time to either attack or give up and leave. Egwene says that they will wait an hour. After that, it will be too dark. As she prepares to give the command, yet another group approaches. They are 10 Aes Sedai, led by Andia Foray. The sisters comprise 2 sitters from the brown, gray, green, white, and yellow. Andia announces that the Hall has chosen to raise Egwene to the Emerlin seat. Elida was taken by the Shanshan. Egwene demands that Andia accedes, that the army may enter the city. The rebels will be accepted back, and the Blue Aja reinstated. Egwene feels joy and satisfaction as she rides into Tar Valon. This begins chapter 46, To Be Forged Again, also from Egwene's point of view. Egwene hastens to the White Tower with Samhain and Gawain behind her. Servants meet her and escort her to a preparation room where Lorraine of the Brown Aja coaches her on the ceremony. Tassan stands guard outside the room. Samhain reports that Bryn has moved the army into the city, and they are helping the Tower Guard put out fires from the assault. She tells Samhain to have the rebel Aes Sedai report to the Sunset Gate to apologize for rebelling. When Egwene is ready, she opens the door to find Gawain waiting. She tells him to wait to his displeasure and goes to the hall. She gasps when she sees a large hole in the wall through which she can see Dragonmount. There are only 11 sitters, including Saren, Dosine, Yukiri, Sain, and Swanna. Talene fled months ago. Velina and Sidore are missing. They were on Varen's list. Eveline is also missing, making her a suspect as a Black Aja member. All three Red Sitters are missing. Duhara left some weeks before on a mission for Elida. Javindra and Pavara just disappeared. Egwene asks Tassan if Sylviana is still imprisoned. She replies yes, but says that Lolaine was freed to join the others at the Sunset Gate. Egwene sends her to bring Sylviana. Saren issues the call, and Yukiri, Sain, and Suana stand for her. Saren then calls for a vote, and all rise. Egwene is then raised to the Emerlin seat. Tassan returns with Sylviana. Egwene berates the sitters for letting Elida destroy the tower. She says Sylviana was the only one brave enough to stand up to her. She then offers Sylviana the position of Keeper of the Chronicles, and Sylviana humbly accepts. Ramonda and Lolaine will be livid when they learn that neither of them will be Keeper. She chastises the sitters again, saying they all made mistakes, including herself, but they must now move forward to make the White Tower strong. They all move to the great square where Egwene addresses all the rebels and most of the others in the White Tower. She admonishes the rebels and tells them that they must work hard to rebuild. The White Tower will once again be whole and complete. The Aes Sedai cheer as Egwene thinks how much work still needs to be done.
The first chapter, there really wasn't much there. I mean, we have they're getting ready for the attack on the White Tower. They've executed all of the Black Aja because they didn't want to keep them for questioning. Egwene learned her lesson with that, with Mahkeeton. You don't want to let them give them any chance to escape. And then she gets called to the White Tower to come and be their Amarlin seat, which, you know, it worked, but I really would have liked to see what would have happened if they had done it the right way, if they had called her the way they should have. Which, you know, in this situation, honestly, you know, I think this was the right call, because it couldn't have worked, because they had to send the Grey out to say, we're willing to make these concessions if you will come and lead us. We'll accept the rebels back. We'll put the Blue Aja back and all this. You know, things that we really expected. The only note that I think worth mentioning is the fact that Lelaine tells Egwene that Sheriam's story is true. All the dreams Tarangriel are missing. Well, Sheriam was missing a finger because she didn't get all of the dreams Tarangriel. Well, we know that the last one that she missed is the one that Suwan had and Suwan used. However, she did make off with the original ring, the one that Varin gave to Egwene, and so they no longer have the original that Elaine can make copies of. They only have the already copied ones. But yeah, that's the only really, really interesting note that, you know, isn't kind of straightforward and expected that happens in chapter 45.
Yeah, I mean, it is, again, one of those kind of lead-in chapters. It is, you know, of course, we get, you know, the description of Sheriam's execution, which is, you know, one of those rare things that we see where, you know, since someone actually has been, you know, put to death, this isn't a battle, this is, you know, all set as part of, you know, the legal system. But yeah, everything that happens here is really a lead in to the rebuilding of the White Towers in the chapter 46. And you know, again, we get another, you know, Gawain Egwene moment, which, you know, kind of, again, is almost trying at this point, because, I mean, you want them to be fine with each other, but there's just not going to be that, you know. And, you know, I think I was better with this discussion between the two of them than I was the previous, but it still seemed to me that, you know, Egwene really was just really stressing the, you know, I can't be doing this right now. You know, right now, your work has to come first. You know, there needed, at least for me, to be a little more of the, you know, yes, I still have feelings for you, and, you know, we will talk about this, just not now. And, you know, it seems like, I mean, that happened in this conversation, but not to the extent that I would have really liked. And I think that partially just comes from my desire to see Gawain have a turnaround and, you know, come back a little more to the more noble and chivalric person that I, you know, remember from early on with him. You know, it seems he's gone down a further path. I was more than overjoyed that she ends up taking Sylviana as a keeper. I just think that was probably the best possible choice that she could have made. And, you know, again, it reinforces that, you know, the Red, and I said this last, you know, the last podcast, the Red really are a secondary Aja that pursues justice, just not in the same way that the Greys do. You know, the Greys are the legal sort of justice, and, you know, the Red are the kind of righteous fury sort of justice, you know, where they are designed a little bit to be retributive, even if they have strayed away from it.
Yeah, the Greys are the lawyers and the Reds are the actual, you know, officers out there enforcing the law.
Yeah. We, of course, know why all the Red Sitters are out of the tower. Egwene is not privileged to that particular information, that two of them have gone off to the Black Tower and might not be coming back at this point.
I really want them to, though. I really like Tavara. She's one of my favorite Reds. Her and Teslin.
It's true. No, I forget. Does Egwene do the entire re-swearing of the oaths in this one, too? I know she doesn't.
She does it, but it happens off-screen. She thinks about it in the epilogue. So it happens off-screen.
All right. Yeah, I didn't remember, but I did seem to recall there being something about, you know, the mention of how it was to unswear the oaths and then re-swear them again so shortly after having sworn them the first time. But yeah, this, you know, and then of course, you know, we get the you know, a true impact of the attack on the tower as well in this chapter. You know, it's not necessarily that there are, you know, holes in the White Tower. The hall of the tower is essentially the heart of the tower. You know, and she walks in and there's this gigantic gaping, you know, hole. And you know, what's the one thing that you can see through the hole? It's Dragonmount.
Dragonmount, yeah. Really interesting because, you know, in my mind, I had always pictured the actual hall of the tower, the actual room. I had always pictured it somewhere in the middle of the tower, you know, kind of central. But no, it's off on the edge. It has to be on the edge in order for there to have been a hole blasted in the wall. And whether it's a result of some Taveren pulling, which would be an odd occurrence if there were no Taveren about, or just how, but the fact that it was perfectly put right above the Omerlin seat, just boom, it is very fortuitous in terms of reminding the tower at all times what had happened. But no, it is really interesting, you know, her and Gawain, which really at this point in time, I mean, we've seen their star-crossed lovers relationship, the way that they behave with each other in that fashion, you know, stealing out and sneaking kisses in back alleys in Camelin. But this is much more the Aes Sedai and Wardur relationship that they have to have, that they have to learn how to use. I don't think they're doing it right. This isn't the right way to for either of them. But it's much closer to the relationship that an Aes Sedai must have with her Wardur, especially the Omerlin Seat. But they do need to find a better balance between the star-crossed lovers and the Aes Sedai Wardur. And then Sylviana. I mean, it was pretty much obvious as soon as she said, bring Sylviana here. I was like, oh good. Sylviana's gonna be the keeper. But still, it is nice to see, and it was a very, very good choice on her part. Again, Sylveana, a great red. A great red. I'm going to have to throw her. Man, I'm just thinking about all my favorite Aes Sedai, and by percentage, I think a lot of them are red. I mean, by the numbers, they're outnumbered by the others, but by percentage, I think the red has the highest percentage of my favorite Aes Sedai. What an interesting concept.
That is an interesting concept. I don't know. I can't really say on my own level, but, well, I mean, we've had more experience, truthfully, with the red than almost any other Asha. When you really come down to it, you've met more of them consistently, I think, than any other Asha. Well, I mean, especially when you take into account the number of sisters that we've met who end up turning into black instead.
Well, and you know, you think about the least favorite sisters, though. My least favorite sisters, the largest majority of them, I think, are probably red as well. Elida, Galena, et cetera, you know. So the best and the worst are found in the red Aja, and you're right, you know, it's because, you know, it's the justice Aja, it's the peace, it's not the peacekeepers, it's the law keepers, the basically the police force of the White Tower. And when you have any form of force like that, it's going to attract both the best, the people who strive for justice and truth, and the worst, the people who strive for power and control. And really, that it's been put together so well, the character mix of women in the Red Aja.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
I think an interesting moment, just a couple of lines, not even that, like one sentence or so in the actual text when they all stand to raise Egwene. You know, that didn't happen in Saladhar. I'm pretty sure it has to be a unanimous vote to raise an initiate to Ammerlin. And if one of the sitters doesn't stand, well then the initiate, the potential Ammerlin, has to go and wash their feet and beg them to allow her to serve. And I think it's interesting that we didn't have that here. I mean, everyone stood up. And then my favorite line is, and then they looked around kind of surprised, wondering if maybe they should have stayed sat down.
Yeah. I mean, but you... The politicking really didn't happen here the way it did in Saladhar. And in some ways that's, you know, sort of encouraging. I mean, we see that the Aes Sedai have been brought to the point that they need to have a strong Ammerlin and one who is, you know, just directly and readily available. You know, someone who can put the tower back together after such amazing division and strife. And it's really kind of, you know, a testament to the Aes Sedai unity.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. It's very telling of the kind of dire straits that they are in right now, that they aren't trying to make a political statement out of it. They're just trying to get the leadership, trying to get the tower back together. I mean, that's why they stood. I want Egwene as Ammerlin because I know that she can get the tower back united as a whole the way it needs to be. And then they're standing thinking, wait, what? Well, maybe I should have tried to make a political statement. I don't know. But you're right. It is very heartening to see the Aes Sedai, these political masters, you know, the worst sort of politicians there are, politicians with extra power, and to see them give it up because they need to, because that's what the world needs, that's what they need, right? Not just they. I think a lot of them are seeing the bigger picture. Well, maybe not. I know Egwene's seeing the bigger picture because in her monologue, She definitely brings it out and says, what the heck have you been doing? The world's in dire straits and you've been fighting like children. And so a lot of them, it's just, you know, finally, the tower's back together. This is a good thing. We can finally, like Egwene says, we can finally get to work on the things that have to be done to get the world ready for the last battle, to make sure that as much of the world survives the last battle as possibly can.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely definitely true. We're really pushing into the, you know, to that last kind of build-up. You know, everything that's going to happen before Tarmon Gaiden is going to have to happen, you know, in the immediate future. And, you know, it's kind of, it's time to put aside the, you know, the differences and the squabbling and, you know, just do what needs to be done, because otherwise the world's going to be in a bad place.
Yes, very much so. And, you know, this gets the tower in just the right spot, I think, for what I assume has to happen in Towers of Midnight. Have you read the first chapter that's available for Towers of Midnight? Have you had a chance to do that yet?
No, I haven't.
Oh man, it's good. But, no, I guess then I won't spoil stuff. I could give a Towers of Midnight spoiler, because there's been enough of it released now that you can actually spoil things. It's amazing. Of course, I haven't read the prologue yet, but I have read two of the chapters. Chapter 1 and Chapter 8, I think it is. But, and you can just see that how much has changed from the middle of this book to the beginning of Towers of Midnight in a good way. But that's, I think, more for the next few chapters. Well, I think that's going to wrap us up for this episode. We want to thank, once again, Encyclopedia Watt for the summaries that we use, and TalkShoe for providing the service which we use to record.
Yes, we also wanted to thank all the listeners. We hope that you have enjoyed this podcast as much as we enjoy making it. If you have any ideas about anything we said, if you see something that we've missed, or you know, really enjoyed something that we discussed, if it brought up any ideas, you know, any sort of theories about what's going to continue in the rest of the books, or what it will happen after the books, crazy theories, not so crazy theories, criticisms. There are a number of ways that you can get a hold of us, which will be coming up in just a moment. And we just wanted, again, to thank you for spending this time with us as we discuss this, you know, series, which we all enjoy so much.
Yep, very much so. And so, until next time, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Serapin Nintomon Shima, Taishite.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by DragonMount.com. To contact us, visit our website, DragonMount.com/podcast.
One of the joys of having chickens, they just got out of their coop.
Are we certain that these Trollocs that have burst out and attacked are actually fresh reinforcements possibly sent through the waves? The waves? A red, a green, and a yellow walk into a bar. The bartender says, "Hey." I really couldn't think of a punchline. Hey, seems this.